Support for WPR comes from WIPS with Toward One Wisconsin, a conference on equity, diversity, and inclusion, May 7th and 8th in Eau Claire. Registration information and more is at t1w.org.
Support for WPR comes from 4imprint, providers of promotional products for businesses, including embroidered apparel, trade show items, and logoed business gifts. More is at 4imprint.com. 4imprint, for certain.
When it comes to only children, three words come up over and over again: lonely, selfish, and maladjusted. But our next guest is here to bust only child myths and talk about the benefits of growing up a singleton. And for parents, having just one kid might be the solution to the ongoing conflict between the demands of parenthood and modern realities.
And we want to hear from you. Are you an only child? Or maybe you're a parent who made the decision to stop at one. Call us at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Or send us an email at talk@WPR.org. Tell us about your experience.
Lauren Sandler is a journalist and an author and an only child herself. Her new book is called One and Only, The Freedom of Having an Only Child and the Joy of Being One. Lauren, welcome.
Hello, fellow only.
So the standard line right out there that we hear over and over, only children are lonely, they're selfish, they're messed up. So as a culture, are we still buying that?
We really are, and it's amazing to me that we are, because as we know, we discontinued the rest of the stereotypes in the 90s, but this one remained somehow. It survived political correctness. It also survived hundreds of studies done over decades and decades disproving that we are lonely, selfish, and maladjusted, and yet it continues.
So why do you think those labels have such staying power when we've evolved in so many other ways?
Well, I have puzzled over this for the 3 years that I was reporting this book. I think that three elements are in play. One was, when we were evolving as a species, we needed to have more of us to survive. And then as we evolved into agrarian humans, we needed more of us to thrive. Children were a labor force, and the more you had, the more you could make it. But then the Industrial Revolution hit, of course, and then suddenly children began to cost more instead of earning more. And meanwhile, women's roles were starting to change, and obviously they've changed radically. But I really think that we still haven't really caught up to notions of what women's freedom really means. And so to be saying you need to mother more, more, more all the time keeps things at least somewhat in the box it's been for a while, which doesn't mean that you can't be much more than a mother if you have more than one child. But to have this social messaging to tell us to have more children all the time, it does seem to be that's sort of an engine behind it.
Well, and as we said, you're an only child who grew up and decided to have only one child. How did
so
your family
far, at least.
So far, uh-huh. So that could change. There's going to be a sequel to your book.
I have a few years to change my mind. People keep joking, oh, you've got a sequel in mind.
Okay, Lauren, you can't cave now. You wrote this book.
Right?
You're in. But, I mean, how did you make those choices? How did your mom make that choice?
Well, for my mom, you know, I actually think it was easier for her to make this choice in the mid-70s than it is right now. You know, it's a time of radical feminism and strong environmentalism. People were really redefining their lives in terms of family planning and population in ways that got some public support, at least in certain zip codes. You know, I grew up in Cambridge, Massachusetts, so that's pretty, I think, familiar territory. And in parts of Wisconsin, you know, the sort of university areas where such ideas were smiled upon instead of frowned upon. And right now, it doesn't really feel that way so much anymore. So her feeling at the time was she and my dad lived in an apartment, and they didn't want to move. And she did great work that she loved, and she didn't want to do less of it. And they wanted to live somewhere where they could pop up and get a good cookie at 9 o'clock at night if they felt like it, and have a little bit of spontaneity. And, you know, it worked out really well. We were sort of a fun, lean team, and my childhood was pretty good for it. I do think it's harder when you're an adolescent and when you're an adult. It's ironic to me that it's the childhood of only children that people are most concerned about, when I do think that it's tougher the older you get. But, you know, I'm making similar calculations now in my own life. I live in New York. I'm a writer. I'm married to a photographer. So we're the idiots who chose low-paying careers in one of the most expensive cities you can live in, and we refuse to give it up. So, you know, this is one of the ways that we suffer for it, I guess. But mainly, you know, we're really happy with our kid. We're crazy about her, and we have a great time. You know, I spent the day with her on a train today coming back from her cousin's house, and the two of us just yapped it up, and I thought, this is pretty great. I don't need to mess with this to be happy. And it's really that feeling that I think leads us a lot, is this is good. We don't need to change it, so why would we?
Well, and even you who's, look at this, you're so comfortable with this. You talk about it on the radio, you wrote a book about it, but you still get branded with the selfish stigma that you've somehow made a selfish choice by having one child, that your mother made a selfish choice. And so it's not only the child that people worry about and sometimes judge, it's the parent, isn't it?
Absolutely. And it's funny, I wasn't that aware of the judgment until I had a kid myself. As an only child, it wasn't something I heard that much. But once you're out there as a parent with just one kid and people ask you, where are your other kids or when are you having them, and you see their faces fall when you tell them, I'm not planning that anytime soon, it really churns something up. And it's hard to escape. You know, I too, even though I'm incredibly comfortable with this and, you know, as I guess we could say very out about it, talking about it on the radio. You know, I watched my daughter be a really great sort of big sister figure to younger cousins all weekend, and I saw how beautiful that is. And when she said to me earlier today, Mom, I want a sister, it's like, Okay, we're going to have this conversation again. We have it all the time. But I do think that it's a conversation that she can have with me, and that's something I really appreciate.
Well, I want to get at some of these tags that only children have long gotten: lonely, selfish, maladjusted. Is there any recent science to back those up? What do we know now about those assumptions?
Well, there isn't. What we know now about loneliness is that only children tend to have a stronger primary relationship with themselves, which is actually like the best armor against loneliness you can have. All human beings are lonely, and so to be able to rely on yourself makes a big difference. That said, and this isn't something which is really borne out in the studies so much as the lived experience, I interviewed tons of people for this book, you know, if you're an only child living in a rural area away from other kids, that can be lonely. If you're an only child who gets homeschooled, that can be lonely. So for only children who go to school and can have other friends around, it doesn't make a difference that much. But for only children who are very much alone, that can be hard. In terms of selfishness, the most recent studies show that both in terms of selfishness and social adjustment, school is the great equalizer. It used to be thought that, you know, that siblings were necessary to kind of beat you up for the world a little bit. And people have found that your classmates can actually beat you up just fine, that there's enough abuse that happens in the classroom and on the playground, that the sort of learning that we get from conflict and competition with our siblings can actually play out with people who aren't related to us as well. Though there certainly is a learning aspect to that. But, you know, as recently as I think last year, 35,000 kids were polled about how many close friends they could name, and only children named just as many as any else. So, you know, furthermore, only children tend to have very, very strong, almost familial friendships. We tend to really cherish and nurture those relationships, because we know if we have a falling out with someone, they're not just going to be at the dinner table every night for the next week. We have to work on it. And so we actually tend to be very good at making friends and making very close, lasting friends.
Yeah, I love how you call that. You say only children are intimacy junkies.
Yeah, well, so, I know I am.
That rang a bell with me, too.
For better or for worse.
Yeah. Do you think that this, I don't know, is it fair to call this prejudice? Against
sure.
only children, is that too strong a word?
No, I mean, I met someone just a couple weeks ago who was telling me a story. You know, she was saying, well, I was in a job interview a while ago, and it came out that I was an only child, and the person who could have hired me looked at me and she said, you know, I'm sorry, just on policy, I don't hire only children.
Wow.
And I thought, wow, what if we were talking about a different minority group? What if she was talking about a racial bias or an age bias or a gender bias? That would be unheard of right now, or at least it should be unheard of right now, but it's really tolerated. And I'm, you know, I certainly don't believe that prejudice against only children is the same social issue is racism. But we at least know that one of them is wrong, and we accept the other one as a given.
So what do you think that families of only children, what kind of conversation should they have to tell each other that kind of, I'm okay, you're okay?
Oh, that's a great question. You know, it's amazing. No one has thought to ask me that question in all of this time talking about this book. Because it's funny, I do feel like our conversation about parenting only children sort of begins and ends with don't do it, instead of how do we do it to feel okay about it. I think it's really important that parents know that only children are fine, or rather, we're not any less fine than anyone else. I mean, parents are going to screw us up whether we have siblings or not, and we'll screw ourselves up too. But I do think that it's really good for parents to know that articulating longing for more children is something that can be really hard on only children, that that can make them really long for something they don't have and not quite feel normal or enough themselves. And to just, you know, be really upbeat, but without being too intense about it, which can be a hard thing to do. You know, one of the beauties of being an only child is that you get all of your parents' undiluted resource, which is not just money, but it's time and energy and attention. But too much attention can be overkill. And so I think it's just important for us to learn how to lay off a little bit and put our kids in the context of other kids, that, you know, that if you're around enough other kids, you know, okay, well, my kid's acting this way because they're five and not just because of who they are. That can be a very liberating thing, both for us and for our children. And I say this having read research, but also having to live with an only child who's five every day. And let me tell you, all five-year-olds have tendencies of the only child stereotype. But it's good to remember what's in play here. But mainly for parents, I think the most important thing, and this is a big part of why I wrote this book, is to protect their own happiness and to own that a bit. I mean, we have been in such a lockdown of parental self-sacrifice in this country.
It's
where
kind of that thing about a happy parent has a happy family and a happy child.
I believe that. My mother really believed that to be a good mother, she had to be a happy person.
And all right. Well, we'll talk more about that. More to come as we talk Only Children. We're talking with Lauren Sandler, author of One and Only. If you'd like to get in on the conversation, give us a call at 800-642-1234. You can also head over to the Central Time Facebook page and leave your comment there. We're talking with Lauren Sandler, author of One and Only, about the freedom of having an only child and the joy of being one. And we want to hear about your experiences. You can call us up at 1-800-642-1234, or you can send an email to talk@wpr.org. If you're an only, how have you enjoyed being an only? And if you have only one, how do you feel about that decision? And we'll go now to our first caller, Tara in Hastings, Minnesota. Hey, Tara.
Hi.
Hey.
I wanted to just thank Lauren for writing this book, because I have one son and I don't want any more children. And it's just such a taboo. I get pressure from everybody, my pediatrician, my in-laws, my parents, everybody, to have more. And I love how Lauren said, you know, the only discussion that's ever really brought up about how to parent only children is to not do it. So I just wanted to thank her for her insight and for just basically saying that it's okay.
Oh, thank you so much, Tara. When I hear from people that they get it from pediatricians or psychologists, I get so mad. So I really appreciate you reminding me that, you know, beyond the notion of a cultural issue that's generally out there or the uncomfortable conversations we have with family or friends sometimes, that there actually is, you know, an entrenched professional bias here, which is a real issue. And I really appreciate that. Thank you for calling.
All right. Thank you so much. Do you have any advice, though, for Tara about what to say to people when they do say things to you like that you'd rather not hear?
Yeah. It's such a hard a hard situation to deal with. You know, I've had moments where the supermarket line, I've spit out, you know, economic factors about the rising inflation of parenting, and I've thought, oh God, that just doesn't get anywhere. So lately I just smile and move on, but yeah, now I just want to push my book at people. What can I say?
All right. Well, good luck, Tara, and thank you for the call. Appreciate it. We go to Kevin in Whitewater next. Hi, Kevin.
Hello, how are you?
Doing well. How are you?
Pretty good. We are the parents of one daughter, and not only is she an only child, but she's an only grandchild on one side of the family. So that really made it interesting right from the start. But the other thing about having an only child that I think is really cool is they can't blame it on anybody else in the family. such as one time our daughter tried to play.
That's one of the worst things about being an only child.
I thought it was just terrific. She tried to blame it on the dog one day, and I'm like, I don't think so.
Yeah, so who's responsible when the kid has an issue? You know, I guess, you know, you can't pass the buck if you're an only child.
It's true.
Yeah, but then again, with only one child, you get to spend more of your resources and time on that one person instead of, you know, having to worry. You know, personally, I've got two brothers, and I couldn't imagine having any more than one child because you just want to spend so much time with one.
Right, I've heard that argument from other parents, Kevin, who went on to have more kids, but they couldn't imagine loving any child more than that one, and that led them to want to stop right there, and some people do. So I don't know, but then, I don't know, how do you think about that, Lauren? Have you heard that before? Sometimes people think that their love is complete with that one child.
Yes, I hear that from a lot of people, and it's something I feel myself, and I know my parents felt themselves. But, you know, I've also watched so many friends have second kids or third kids who have felt that too, and then they really love that next kid. And so I think it's amazing how much capacity for love that we have, way beyond what we can ever imagine. And so I don't know. I think that it's hard to make a decision based on that, but I think that it's also okay to trust yourself. And if you know yourself and you know that's how you feel, and the only reason that you would feel compelled to have another kid is because you feel like it's the right thing to do, because you don't want to be a selfish person and the world has told you that, or you don't want your kid to be messed up and the world has told you that. I want people to have just confidence in being happy where they are.
Well, I want to get to, before we're through here, one more question that I think is an important one that you raise, that there's so much talk lately of a work-life balance and having it all. And we're finding, you know, with the economy, resources, you know, really having it all is getting harder and harder to do, if not becoming impossible. How does this idea of having only one child factor into that discussion?
Oh, to me, it is huge. And it has been just gobsmacking to me that it's been absent in this having it all conversation. To me, the answer to the having it all question lies, frankly, in family policy that we don't have, but the rest of the world gets to have. You know, we don't have the support in America that exists anywhere else. And I don't just mean what the EU looks like. You know, we're ranked for third or fourth worst family policy in the world. We're only bested there by Liberia and Suriname. We tie with Swaziland. That's how bad it is. And yet, in our country, we say, you need to have more kids, you need to love it more than anyone else, and we're going to help you less than anyone else. So what this does is it puts the impetus on our individual decisions so much more, which doesn't mean that in other countries people aren't having only children based on the same calculus. You know, right now it's a month ago, the UK reached half only children, and in Asia it's obviously huge, in Germany and Austria and Ireland. It's a really growing phenomenon everywhere. But we are the place in which it, I think, makes the biggest difference, because we have the most to do as parents with the least support. And because of that, it feels like, okay, well, what if you do work more? What if you actually, God forbid, want to do something beyond just live your life at home and at the office? I mean, it's always so interesting to me that we call it work-life balance. That's rarely what we're talking about. We're really just talking about work-parenting balance. You know, work-life balance never takes into account, what if you want to have cocktails with a friend or go to the movie or, you know, have dinner alone with your husband or, God forbid, take a walk by yourself or read a novel, all things that I didn't stop wanting to do just because I had a kid. And I think that if you have one kid, not only are your resources undivided between more children and you can therefore devote them to your one child, but you can actually save a little bit for yourself. And if that's how we get the selfish brand as parents of only children, I think that, you know, I'm okay with parental selfishness. I also think that having those additional resources and some more time allows us to be more active as citizens and more active in our communities. You know, it's ironic that we don't have better family policy because, of course, all the people who would advocate for that are too busy taking care of their kids and working all the time. So it's really hard to make our society look a little bit more like what I think some of us might really benefit from, because we don't have time for that sort of civil action. We don't have time for an engagement beyond our to-do list at work and at home. And I think that this is a way of opening that up. That doesn't mean that I think that everyone should have one kid. I think that people should really do what they want. But I do think that if what you might want is to have one, or if that's a choice that your body has made for you and you're feeling lousy about it, there's a lot of freedom in there, and there's a real benefit in there, and that's something that we could actually start celebrating instead of demonizing.
Well, Lauren, it'll be so interesting to see if you start changing things with your book, and I appreciate you being with us today.
Oh, thank you so much. It was a pleasure.
That was Lauren Sandler. Her book is called One and Only, The Freedom of Having an Only Child and the Joy of Being One. It's Central Time. I'm Veronica Rickert. You're with us on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio on this Memorial Day Monday. Coming up on Central Time, we'll get the scoop on how to make tasty homemade veggie burgers. First, we're talking to an expert about the oral history program at the Wisconsin Veterans Museum. On this Memorial Day, we thought it would be the perfect time to learn about how the histories of Wisconsin-connected veterans are collected and how they're used. Ellen Brooks is with us. She's the oral history archivist for the Wisconsin Veterans Museum. Ellen, welcome to Central Time.
Thanks, Veronica. Thanks for having me.
So when this oral history program got started, what was the goal initially?
The initial goal was to collect the first-person experiences of veterans from every conflict. We collect stories from veterans of any era and every branch of military. And the initial goal was just to try to get that first-person perspective. We have a lot of artifacts, we have a lot of facts and dates, but we really wanted to learn about what it was like to be in the military, what it meant to serve.
How are stories that are told in person, the way that you collect them in this program, different than written memories, for instance?
I think what happens in an interview, the interviews are conducted either by myself or by our trained volunteers who are mostly veterans themselves. And what can happen in that person-to-person interaction can be somewhat magical. I think people really tend to open up when they have another person in front of them listening and caring about what they're saying. So we have people who tell us things in these interviews that they've never expressed before, that they probably might not have written down before. And so I think what happens there can be very emotional and very, very exciting.
So it sounds like a really precious kind of storytelling that you might not get otherwise. Can you tell us about one or two of the stories, or even just a little anecdotes that stood out for one reason or another?
Sure. I think a lot of times what has happened since I've been on board and some of the interviews that I've participated in, I'll be connected by a veteran's son or daughter or grandson or granddaughter, and they're really excited about having their grandfather or grandmother or father or mother's story told, and they just don't know exactly how to go about it. And one of the first interviews I did was actually a grandson who put me in touch with his grandfather, and I sat down with them together, and we did the recording. I, of course, did the questions and all the technical stuff, but to have the grandson there to be a part of it, that was really special.
And so maybe it brings the people together closer within the family.
It does. And I think that sometimes it can be tricky within a family to get your veteran relative to open up about these things. Sometimes they don't want to be overly emotional. They don't want to say anything that might be disturbing or unsettling. So I think that having this somewhat professional experience with the Veterans Museum, it kind of helps bridge that gap that might have been there otherwise between veterans and civilians.
How do you find the veterans to collect their stories?
It's predominantly word of mouth, just people telling people about their own experience with the Veterans History Museum. They just let them know that this exists. And we also have been doing some marketing in terms of Facebook, and we've got a new blog out. So we just kind of slowly wait until people come to us. But we're going to start kind of more aggressively doing some outreach. We've got some events planned this summer, so I'll be out there and letting people know that the program exists and they should come share their stories with us.
And so in general, when you've got a veteran who's ready to share their story, do they come to the Veterans Museum or do you go to them?
Either one. We would like to do whatever is most convenient. So we do travel all over the state to interview people if they're more comfortable having the interview done at their home. If they're Madison located, then sometimes we meet up at some type of mutually convenient place. We've actually been using some of the rooms at the main Madison Library, which has been very convenient. I do have a couple interviewers who are based out of Milwaukee. So they'll usually be assigned to the Milwaukee-based veterans. But we go to homes if that's what works the best, and especially with some of the older veterans, that's usually easier, and we just want them to be really comfortable with the experience.
So you are talking about things that I can imagine would be sensitive, that would have a lot of emotional resonance even over the years later. How does the person collecting the story, talking to the veteran, go about, you know, getting trained and making sure that they're a sensitive listener?
Sure. Well, obviously, that's very important, and we take that very seriously. Besides myself, who I have training, I actually have a master's in oral history, so kind of extensive training in the art of interviewing. But I sit down with people who are interested in becoming interviewers, and several of them had been trained before I even took this position on. And a lot of them, I think I mentioned before, are veterans themselves. So that already helps. It gives them a leg up. A veteran tends to feel more comfortable and open up more easily with another veteran. But usually there's a training session that just involves a lot of technical things, how to work the recorder, a lot of, you know, how to handle the paperwork, just to get all of that stuff out of the way. And then just the art of listening. We talk a lot about silences, letting silence be comfortable, taking breaths, reflective questions. So it's usually a session, and then it is also the type of thing that the more you do an interview, I think the better you get, the more comfortable you are. So we've got some really skilled interviewers.
What are these oral histories like, and what kind of stories are the veterans telling?
They're very interesting because they vary so vastly. We've got over 1,900 interviews in our collection now, and some of them are 30 minutes long, and we have one, I found one recently, that was 5 hours of tape.
Wow.
So it can completely depend on, you know, obviously these are personal narratives, so these are individuals that have their own characters. Some are much more verbose than others. Some, you know, aren't that interested in talking. So it can vary widely, and we get a lot of funny stories because a lot of what happens in military service, there's a complete side of humor that I think people often overlook. So we get a lot of funny anecdotes, a lot of stories of friendship and camaraderie, a lot of stories about, you know, getting mail, how exciting the mail is, how bad the food is, a lot of your everyday type stuff. And then we do get some of those harder, heavier combat stories, injuries, near-death experiences. And so it just depends on that certain situation that the veteran went through.
Today is Memorial Day, and we're remembering fallen service people.
Mm-hmm.
How do people talk about death and trauma in the military and when they're telling these stories?
I think that it's changed a little from the World War II era to today. Not to say that it's gotten any easier. I think that today's veterans, the younger generation, not that it's easy for them to open up, but I think that they may have learned from the past generations. I think it's still a very somber thing, obviously, something to be dealt with a lot of respect. The Wisconsin Veterans Museum is part of the Wisconsin Department of Veterans Affairs, and I think that veterans can go and use these services and these benefits and hopefully find a place to talk and open up. But it's never easy. There's really no good answer for that.
Does there tend to be a moment for the veterans where something transformative happens, especially when they're talking about things that they may have carried with them for a long time? Or is it primarily something for the listener and the people who listen later on?
I think it can definitely be both, and I think it often is both. Some of the people that we've interviewed have turned around and said they would like to become interviewers themselves just because of the relief that they felt. And obviously an oral history is not a therapy session, so we're not asking people to completely bare their souls, and there's a different purpose here, and it is professional. But I think that there is a sense of relief that can happen from the oral history interview, not only sharing your story, but also knowing that that story is going to go and be preserved and listened to and used by future generations.
For those people who are listening who may want to participate in this project, or who might have a family member who has a story to tell and maybe hasn't shared it, how can they get in touch and maybe prepare themselves for telling their story?
Sure. The best thing to do is to contact me, and I can go ahead and give you that number and my email. There's also a page on the museum's website, and the website is wisvetsmuseum.com. And there's a little tab at the top that says Veterans, and you can click that, and that will navigate you to a little interview request form. So once I receive that request form, then I get in touch with either the relative who contacted me or the veteran themselves, and we talk a little bit about the program, if they have any questions. And I also send them a sheet that's basically a little what to expect description for the interview, so they can be comfortable, they know what they're getting into going in. Sometimes veterans like to take notes just so they can kind of stay on track with the interview. Sometimes people like to bring in pictures to jog their memory. And that's all fine. We encourage people to prepare in any way that makes them comfortable.
Perfect. Well, Ellen, thank you so much for coming on and sharing this with us today.
Sure. Thank you for having me.
We've been talking to Ellen Brooks, oral history archivist for the Wisconsin Veterans Museum. This is Central Time. I'm Veronica Rickard. It's Memorial Day, and while summer technically starts next month, today kind of is the unofficial start of summer. And with weather in the 70s and 80s around Wisconsin this weekend, it really does kind of feel like summer, which means there's really no legitimate reason not to start grilling out. For all of you grillers, veggie burgers are a pretty popular non-meat option. You probably tried a couple of the things that have availability at the grocery store in the frozen foods aisle. But if you're looking to mix things up, there's a whole world of homemade veggie burgers made with everything from beets to lentils. And here with us now to guide us through the possibilities of the veggie burger world is Terry Milligan. She's a professional chef and culinary instructor based in Door County. Terry, welcome to Central Time.
Well, hello. Thanks for having me. I'm always happy to talk about food.
Well, that's perfect today. Well, part of the appeal of, you know, a beef burger, it's simple. It's ground meat and it tastes usually charred and juicy and salty. Is that the goal of the veggie burger, to kind of replicate the beef burger experience, or is it just kind of a different animal altogether?
I think it's a different animal because the beef is something, you know, it's pretty straightforward. What you get is what you know you've got. With your vegetable burgers, you need to be a little more mindful of what goes in to make that vegetable burger, because it's got to have a texture that somebody is going to enjoy. It's got to have flavor, and it's got to have enough moisture to hold together, which, if those of you who have tried novicely to make some vegetable burgers might have had some problems with them initially, because it is a delicate balance sometimes to get all three of those to work together.
Well, I think veggie burgers have come a long way. I was someone who was trying them from the very beginning, and I really think now people are getting more creative, and the textures are changing too. What do you think has changed in veggie burgers?
Well, I think the textures change in a variety of ways. It's, you know, used to be you only thought maybe of legumes as your basis of a vegetable burger. But now with all the grains that people are beginning to cook with and feel more comfortable with, they've always been there, but people haven't been that comfortable with them. That's helping out a lot in creating interesting textures, as well as adding vegetables and all sorts of different vegetables and herbs and fresh herbs and dried spices. All of that can really create some interesting flavor profiles in these vegetable-based burgers.
And when you're making veggie burgers, one of the pitfalls can be dryness, that you end up with something that's not at all juicy and just maybe tastes like ground-up beans or something very basic like that. How do you make a veggie burger, you know, kind of moist?
Well, with the legume-based ones, when you're using a chickpea, something like that, you can chop, not really chop them, but kind of mush them like with a potato masher. You want to make sure you still have some of that consistency of a bean in there. You don't want to puree it in a food processor. I like to use just a potato masher. So you still get some of that chunk, but you're also getting some moisture out of those items to work with. Of the lentil burger that I had in the Milwaukee Journal last week was interesting because you actually cooked the lentils down to such a degree that they were softer than you'd usually make them, and that created additional moisture. So those types of things are ways you can add moisture. Then, of course, you can also add some eggs. A couple of the recipes I have eggs in them, and that creates a little bit of moisture to them as well. And just some of the vegetables that are pure or that are chopped and put in there can create some moisture as well. The chickpea burger that I have in the article has onions in it, but we really ground them up pretty finely initially, so it became more of a paste almost, and that was created a lot of the moisture in it.
And I'm going to point out that we do have your recipes up on the Central Time Facebook page, including that chickpea walnut burger that you were just talking about. And in terms of getting the whole thing, you know, to stick together on a grill and not fall apart so you're eating veggie burger shards, is there a secret to that?
Well, what I always recommend is actually just searing them in the kitchen in a pan beforehand, because then you've got them seared and kind of together and ready to go. When you're ready to do your, you can do that 2-3 hours ahead of time and just have them seared. When you're ready to do your barbecue outside, I don't recommend just putting them on a grill like you would a normal beef burger, because then you will have the possibility of pieces falling through. But with all the new contraptions that they've got for grilling out, you can get one of those vegetable grill baskets that's flat and it has little holes in the bottom, and it's kind of a Teflon nonstick coating type thing to put on the grill. You can put those pre-seared burgers then on those type of baskets and finish them off there. So you get the smoky flavor, but you're also not going to lose any little bits of vegetable burger down in your charcoal.
Okay, so you're adding an extra step, but as a result, you get a burger that kind of holds together.
You are, and you can pre-sear those, like I said, you know, hours ahead of time. Just keep them in the refrigerator. They're ready to go, and you're, you know, kind of final cooking and heating them up out there.
Would you walk us through another one of your recipes? Let's see, you've got one, the lentil veggie burger with spicy mango salsa. How does that one come together?
Well, that is an interesting burger that is from a place out in California called the Golden Door. And what they did, and I learned this when I was out there doing some work, they cooked those red lentils, and they like to use the red lentils a lot. The red has a little bit more color, so that's kind of makes it a little more, you know, you want things to look good too. So by adding with the old burgers that we used to have looked like just little hockey pucks. So we want to make it look really pretty. So they've got the red lentils in that are cooked kind of to a thick paste, where you still see a few little lentils in there that aren't cooked through, but a lot of them are more of a paste, and that creates that moisture. And then what's interesting with this one is there's a lot of, like 5 or 6 different vegetables in it, but I coarsely chop them individually in a food processor, not together. And that way you can control the dice. You don't want them pureed. You just want them coarsely chopped. It just takes a second. So you put the broccoli in, then you put the carrots in, then you'll put the potatoes in, and you make sure everything is kind of uniformly chopped. And that gives it an interesting texture as well. And what's nice about this is the seasoning, which is yellow curry and smoked paprika. Not just paprika, but smoked paprika. And that smoked paprika gives it a little smoky taste, and I also usually make this gluten-free. So I use homemade gluten breadcrumbs in it. So that kind of, and it's dusted with cornmeal, which is gluten-free, so we're all set for those who can't have flour and gluten in their diet.
Perfect. That sounds good. How long do these take to make? Do they take a little more time?
Well, they'll take a little more time than just putting a patty together, of course. But I don't think if you've got all, I always say, get all your materials together before you start, and then you should be able to put this together in a half an hour at, you know, with cooking time. And while the lentils are cooking, you can chop your vegetables. Then you can put them all together and you've got it. This one I happen to serve with a mango salsa, which is really just fresh mangoes diced with a little chili, some cilantro, lime juice, and red, if you can afford the lime juice these days, the lime juice, the cilantro, and the red onion.
Okay, and there's one more that we've got to talk about before we let you go, the double-decker portobello. I'm a huge mushroom fan, so what do you do with these guys?
Well, this is a nice one. You're talking about, boy, it takes a little time. This one doesn't take any time, so this is a great one if you want to do a vegetable selection but don't have a lot of time. So find 12 large portobello mushroom caps. Take the stems off. I brush them with a little bit of extra virgin olive oil and a nice quality balsamic vinegar. And this one you can put right on the grill because those are going to stay together quite nicely. So I grill them first with the gill side down, and that's just because some of the moisture from that gill cooking will go away and keep your mushroom burger from getting too moist in this section. And then you can take those off. You just put a slice of tomato, fresh tomato, a little fresh mozzarella, and a couple of basil leaves in between. You could put it on a salad, or you can put it on a bun. And you've got a double-decker. You've got that chew that comes from having that portobello mushroom. And then the flavor of the mozzarella, the basil, and the extra virgin olive oil, and the balsamic vinegar. So it's a really easy one to do in a pinch.
Oh, it sounds really yummy. Well, for non-vegetarians, Terry, who might be skeptical about the veggie burger, what do you recommend as a good jumping off point? And we've got about 30 seconds.
The first one to try?
Yeah.
I would actually go for the chickpea walnut burger because you've got a little bit of walnut in there for crunch. I think they're going to find it's surprisingly chewy, like a hamburger. So that I will say is courtesy of a restaurant in Milwaukee called Stacked that just does burgers, but they wanted to add some vegetarian burgers to their menu, and this was one of their most popular. So
right.
I think that's a really nice starting out point.
Great, and we're going to have to leave it there. We're out of time. Terry, thank you so much, and have a great day.
Well, thanks for having me.
We've been talking to Terry Milligan, professional chef and culinary instructor based in Door County.